You are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss.
Step by step along this march, can be won, can be won. Many stones can form an arch, seemingly none.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions and is sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at UMKC. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being underwritten by Plumbers Local 8 and IBEW Local 1464. Plumbers Local 8 has been a part of Kansas City since 1890. The plumber protects the health of the nation. IBEW Local 1464 reminds all union members to support each other and encourage all workers to buy union and American-made products. On tonight's show, it's our second show on alt labor. That's alternative approaches to organizing and running unions. We'll spend the hour with Jane McAlevey, whose book, Raising Expectations and Raising Hell, is a controversial memoir of her decade as an organizer and union leader for SEIU. We'll ask her what went wrong in Florida in 2000, where she worked for the AFL-CIO, and how she helped keep tenant health care out of Kansas City, and how unions need to change. In the news, good news, union membership went up in 2015. And Walmart gets nailed by the NLRB. Our feature at the end of the show is Washington Window on Workers with Mark Grunberg, who will tell us the latest on the TPP. Now for the news.
The news from our side. The New York Times reports, even after Leo Pereira was laid off a year ago from his technology job at Walt Disney World in Orlando, Florida, and spent his final months there training a temporary immigrant from India to do his work, he still hoped to find a new job at Disney. But despite his good intentions there and his good record, he was thrown away. Something similar happened to Dina Moore, and now both are suing Disney and two global consulting companies, HCL and Cognizant, which bought in the foreign workers who replaced them. They claim the companies colluded to break the law by using temporary H-1B visas to bring in immigrant workers, knowing that Americans would be displaced from their jobs. After Moore was laid off, she applied for more than 150 other jobs at Disney. She did not get one. Their lawsuits are the first time Americans have gone to federal court to sue both outsourcing companies that imported immigrants and the American company that contracted with those businesses, claiming that they collaborated intentionally to supplant American workers with H-1B workers. A furor over the layoffs in Orlando last January brought to light many other episodes in which American workers, mainly in technology, but also in accounting and administration, said they had lost jobs to foreigners on H-1B visas and had to train replacements as a condition of their severance. The foreign workers, mostly from India, were provided by outsourcing companies, including the two named in the lawsuits, which have dominated the H-1B visa system, packing application process to win an outsized share of the quota set by Congress of 85,000 visas per year. The Labor Department opened investigations of the outsourcing companies, the direct employees of the temporary immigrants, at Disney and at Southern California Edison, a utility that laid off hundreds of American workers in 2014. The investigations are continuing. At least 30 former Disney workers also filed complaints with the Federal Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, claiming that they face discrimination as American citizens. Sarah Blackwell, a lawyer from Sarasota representing the former Disney employees, said that the suits charged that the companies lied under oath when they said that no Americans would lose their jobs. Disney had vigorously denied any violations, saying it requires its contractors to obey all laws. Here in Kansas City, Cerner Corporation is a large employer of H-1B visa workers.
And the NLRB administrative law judge ruled last week that Walmart broke the law in 2013 when it fired 16 workers who went on strike. The judge ordered Walmart to offer the workers their jobs back within 2 weeks and make them whole for any lost wages. Of course, Walmart can and might appeal. The company spokesman told the Huffington Post that the retailer still believes it acted lawfully and will pursue all our options. The case stemmed from a series of high-profile strikes coordinated by the union-backed group, Our Walmart, including a trip workers made to the company headquarters in Bentonville, Arkansas. Several of the workers who took part ended up losing their jobs. Walmart maintained that the firings were legal because the strikes were intermittent and the workers' absences weren't excused. However, the judge, Godfrey Carter, ruled that the strikes were protected by law and that Walmart had no right to discipline workers for taking part in them. Carter also ordered Walmart to expunge any disciplinary infractions against those employees and to read a notice in the store where they worked informing employees of their rights under the law.
Following up on its investigation about the lack of government care and compensation for tens of thousands of nuclear workers, some here in Kansas City, poisoned by radiation and toxic chemicals over the years, McClatchy newspapers and the Kansas City Star report that their articles have lit a fire under Congress. They say Congress is under growing pressure to investigate what went wrong with a $12 billion federal program aimed at helping them. Colorado Democratic Representative Jared Polis called it disgraceful, and he, Representative Emanuel Cleaver, and Missouri Senator Claire McCaskill, along with others, are pushing for hearings. New Mexico Senator Tom Udall said the program had been plagued with delays and bureaucratic hurdles. Too often, workers die waiting for compensation that they never receive. McClatchy reported that 107,394 current and former nuclear workers have sought compensation for cancers and other illnesses after working at 325 current and defunct nuclear sites across the nation. Overall, the federal government had made payments to more than 53,000 sickened or dead workers under the Energy Employees Occupational Illness Compensation Program, which launched in 2001. In many cases, the money went to surviving relatives who'd taken on the battles of their deceased loved ones. And 7,762 workers died after filing for compensation, getting nothing, according to McClatchy's analysis of government records.
This week, the Bureau of Labor Statistics issued its annual report on union membership for the previous year. And it's kind of good news. Nationwide, union membership rose in 2015 by 219,000. There were 14,795,000 members last year of unions, but the union density ratio was still just at 11.1% of the workforce. The survey showed unionists still concentrate in the Northeast, the Great Lakes, and the Pacific Coast, and are fewest in the anti-union South. The most union-heavy states are New York and Hawaii, and it showed female union workers are close to pay parity with union men. Membership increases occurred even as unions battle right-wing politicians and their business backers over the right to organize, union dues, and other issues. The right-wing triumphs were most obvious in a sharp decline in one state, Wisconsin. Public workers are still five times more likely to be unionized, 35.2%, than private sector workers at 6.7%, with teachers and public safety workers leading the way. Public and private densities changed little from 2014. The unionists widened their salary edge over non-union workers, making $204 more per week. The really good news was that North Carolina added 47,000 members, overtaking South Carolina, which now is in last place in union density. And in Missouri and Kansas, where unions added both numbers and density in 2015, Missouri gained 16,000 union members, moving from 8.4 to 8.8% of the workforce. And Kansas's union membership jumped by 15,000, moving up to 8.7% density. That's the news from our side. The news tonight was read by Shaikalyn Hams, Molly Madden, Jen Zaman, and I'm Judy Ansel.
It was wet down in the city on a crowded street. I heard some poets making music, strumming on their guitars. They made rhythms flow. They made beauty out of life's confusion. It sure seems funny to me now and then when I think about this world we live in.
We're living in
people struggling everywhere, and the force of life don't give in. Subway, I saw flowers grow out of the rubbish and the ashes. It seems to me I heard a baby's cry right in the middle of a life's disaster. I saw garden in a young child's smile and paradise.
Hi, this is Judy Ansel. I read Jane McAlevey's book, Raising Expectations and Raising Hell, My Decade Fighting for the Labor Movement, just last fall, a little late as it was published in 2012. Jane grew up in suburban New York City, the daughter of a local politician who raised her amidst political campaigns and a lot of controversy because of his radical views. She was a student leader at the State University of New York, generating successful protests against tuition hikes and university investments in apartheid South Africa. Dropping out of college, she did construction work in Nicaragua during the Contra War on the side of the Sandinistas, then worked on an organic farm for a year. After that, it was environmental justice at the Earth Island Institute in California. Then, deciding she was at heart an organizer, she went to work for the Highlander Center in Tennessee. That's the outfit that trained both labor and civil rights leaders like Rosa Parks. And she ended up at the AFL-CIO conducting an experimental organizing campaign in Connecticut, and then on to SEIU in Pittsburgh, Kansas City, and finally for a long stretch in Las Vegas. Since she left SEIU, Jane has been in school at NYU getting a PhD and is now working as a postdoc in the Harvard Law School's Labor and Work-Life program. Welcome to the show, Jane.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
And thanks so much for sharing your time with us.
My pleasure.
I want to take the first half of the show to talk about your organizing experience and the lessons you learned, and then in the second half, talk about the future of working class organizing and your new book. So,
great.
Let's start where you did in the book, right after the 2000 election. You were in Florida, and you were sent there by the AFL-CIO in the wake of the butterfly ballot fiasco. You and your team were somehow supposed to help Al Gore reverse the vote for Bush. You encountered tons of hopping mad senior citizens who intended to vote for Gore but somehow voted for Bush. Meanwhile, Republican hit squads were mobilizing and accusing your side of trying to steal the election. But all the Gore people, and consequently the AFL-CIO, wanted you to do was affidavits and recounts. You say they missed a movement moment, thus Bush won. What did you mean by a movement moment?
You know, I think a movement moment, if you think about the civil rights movement, for sake of argument, right, that's probably the more recent movement moment, or the anti-Vietnam War sort of movement in this country. What I mean by movement moment is this. There are times in people's lives in this country and around the world where ordinary people decide, you know, they're going to, like, skip, you know, going to, like, you know, their pool club. They're going to skip the card game. You know, they're going to pick the kids up late, or they're going to make a date for someone else to pick their kids up from school. And frankly, there's something they got to go do, and it really matters a lot to them, and it has to do with throwing their body into something called the change process. And there are rare moments when that happens in this country. And when it happens in very large numbers, like across the country, is when we have things like the labor movement in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s. It's when we saw the civil rights movement. It's when we saw the anti-Vietnam Vietnam War movement, the women's movement, et cetera. And since then, we haven't really had one that's gotten to national scale, quite like we think of those big prior movements. But there are movement moments that are happening all the time in this country. They happen in regions. They happen in a city. Maybe they happen in one state. Or you see giant protests. But it isn't just a protest. And I want to really... That's actually a really key point, is that a movement moment is not just a protest. It's not just Occupy. It's not just Zuccotti Square. It's actually a sustained period when people are prepared to sort of forego normal things in their lives because their expectations have been raised that something different is about to happen and that they themselves can actually make something different happen. And that's what was happening in Florida. I mean, there was, when I landed on the ground in Florida after the Florida recount, there was this moment where people realized, holy mackerel, like we may be experiencing the closest thing to a coup that we've experienced in this country where something terribly wrong is happening. And people by the tens of thousands in Florida, in condominium complexes, you think about who was in South Florida, which is where a lot of the drama played out. You know, and it was a ton of retired unionized workers from New York City and Boston and the New York States and people who had been raised in a different generation of the labor movement who were now retired, living on pensions that used to actually sustain people in Florida, who were suddenly told that, you know, this crazy ballot that they had pulled, you know, that had them voting for whatever, you know, a totally Pat Buchanan. And these were like daughters and sons of New York Jews whose parents had come out of the concentration camps. They're like, wait a minute, you're telling me I just voted for Pat Buchanan? People were ready to move. And that's a movement moment. And just to sum up that little point of that part of the opening of the book, what I was instructed to do by the National Democratic Party and the National Labor Movement was to demobilize people, was to calm them down and make them think everything would work out in the legal process. That's called squelching a movement moment.
Yeah. It starts the book with a real bang and gets people's attention. Before you went to Florida, you actually were a part of a experimental organizing project that was set up in the early days of the John Sweeney administration at the AFL-CIO. And it was there that you developed your concept called whole worker organizing. That's as distinct from the kind of organizing that unions usually do, which focus solely on the workplace and workplace issues. Could you explain what you mean?
Absolutely. Probably my favorite topic besides power. They're related. So when I was sent, this is an important moment. There was a... You know, in the mid-1990s, we had a, you know, people who don't know, we had a huge change at the National Labor Federation, and a new generation of trade union leaders came in. And for a little while there was incredible promise. They were being experimental. We were setting up all sorts of campaigns across the country. And I had the good fortune, you know, to be hired to run one of these experimental campaigns. And by experimental, I mean literally it was an experiment. Like, I was given some money. They said, go hire some staff, you're going to go work with this team of unions, and go see if you can buck the trend. The trend was the decline of the labor movement. We're losing a lot of union elections. We are concession bargaining. American workers are being forced to surrender more and more at the bargaining table and turn it over to their employers, who we now know 20 years later did nothing but get richer and richer for the last 20 years as America's workers were being asked to pay for the excesses of banks and corporations. And so I got sent to Connecticut to work with four different unions, which was very unusual to do a multi-union campaign. And the challenge was we were sent into a suburban region, right, because trade unions historically have a base in sort of urban regions, but we know that the American population is moving out into the suburbs. So they said, you're going to go to the suburbs. It's a non-union region. It's actually a sort of red voting, meaning conservative voting region in an otherwise blue state. That was Connecticut at the time. So you're going to get sent, you're going to get dropped in to a region that's got very low union density, hardly any unions, no public consciousness about unions, and we're going to ask you to try and build unions really fast, win a bunch of union elections, and see if you can do, you know, see if you can reverse the trend. So to make a long story short, you know, I sort of get there and I realize, wow, we got a problem. Like, people here don't know much about unions. Now think about this. This is 20 years ago almost. It's like a metaphor for large sections of the country now. So there we go. I'm dropped into Connecticut in this region where it's a service economy, a lot of low wages. People don't know much about unions, including the workforce. We have a ton of immigrant workers in the region and then a lot of young workers who just didn't grow up in union households. So you know, as the North deindustrialized and shipped all the jobs to the South, you had this young generation and a generation of immigrants who didn't have contact with America's traditional unions. So we wound up growing in some ways, it's a very old way of organizing. It's actually what the labor movement in this country did in the 1920s, 30s, 40s, and 50s. We realized that to win union campaigns, we had to, first of all, win over the broader population to the cause of unions. And second of all, that we actually had to look for ways to build power outside of the workplace because we simply didn't have any power as a bunch of unions going into a non-union region. And so what that meant for us was we had to look around and do a power structure analysis and scour the broader landscape and figure out, well, which institutions that might be sympathetic to the concept of workers doing better have some power in this region up against some very powerful employers. And this will be different in every region. Part of why I like to do something called a power structure analysis is because every city and every state and every region is different, right? Kansas City is not the same thing as San Francisco, is not the same thing as Chicago, et cetera. So each region requires great attention to detail about how does power flow in this region. So we actually started out by doing a big project to figure out how power was flowing in that region. And once we understood it, you know, I sort of realized we don't have a lickin', you know, anything of trying to do a traditional union campaign here. We're going to have to go out big on some non-traditional issues for labor. We're going to have to find some issues that really resonate with the whole broader public. And we're going to have to build some alliances with some people who don't have a lot of contact with the labor movement. In that region, it meant ministers and religious leaders. And we're going to have to help persuade them that we're a good thing. And the only way we can think to do that is to work on some issues that aren't about wages and working conditions. And our decision, in short, after a lot of research, was that there was an acute affordable housing crisis, and that we were going to have to go out as trade unions and run a massive campaign that was going to make us very popular very quickly, and not just run it as a PR exercise, by the way, run it to win. And that's really different than some of the PR stuff that's happening now, which we can come back to later. But we decided we were going to have to go all out and win on an issue that was not a traditional union issue so that we could win over the hearts and minds of the broader public to the cause of America's labor unions. And in 2 very short years, that's exactly what we did. We won 31 union campaigns on the heels of running a very big campaign around affordable housing, and we made trade unions inseparable from the broader good. And we won over a lot of converts who were people who were very suspicious of unions when we first got there, including a lot of very important religious and faith leaders. And as soon as the power structure, meaning the mayor's office and the big CEOs from the big Fortune 500 corporations in Southern Connecticut, which is where the whole place was Fortune 500 corporations, 14 Fortune 500 corporations had their world headquarters in Southern Connecticut at the time. That's who we're going up against in terms of public image. And the minute we began to run the affordable housing campaign, they thought they were going to get us because they ran a message saying, oh, they're just making it up. They're not really committed to affordable housing. They're just doing that to pull the wool over your eyes. You know what I mean? And we were like, no, we're dead serious here. Like, the way America's unions won and built trade unions in the 30s and 40s and 50s in this country is because they were embedded deeply in the community. And we have forgotten that in our trade union movement. And so we decided we're going to take a very old page from the American labor movement. We're going to make it current. We're going to make it modern. We're going to bring technology into it. We're going to bring some new thinking into it. But we're going to borrow and reach back into the 1930s and 40s. We're going to embed ourselves in the community really deeply. We're going to look at a worker not just as someone who's at work, but a worker as someone who lives in a broader community and has a broader set of issues, and we're going to work on all those issues at once.
Well, it was really an impressive case study, and I think that the lesson of that is one that our unions here and probably everywhere in the United States really need to grasp. I want to move ahead, and I can't avoid asking you to tell about your brief sojourn in Kansas City. I know it wasn't the most important part of your book, but I think it'll be of interest to our folks. You came here in 2002 at the time of the sale of our nonprofit hospital chain, Health Midwest. This is a very different kind of campaign than the one you just described. By then, you were working for SEIU, for Andy Stern, their president, and he sent you here. What did he send you here to do?
Well, you know, and that's, I mean, this is, I mean, I think it's of interest, too, even though you're right, and I'm sorry to Kansas City's audience that it doesn't receive a long discussion in the book. It's partly because I feel like it was a it was almost a painful chapter for me. It was was the beginning of my learning curve of what was happening at SEIU in some ways. So Andy, I didn't really have contact with Stern at that point, even though I had just become National Deputy Director of Strategic Campaigns at one of the largest unions in the country. But my immediate supervisor, Larry Fox, who's a truly brilliant man, Larry Fox was head of the healthcare division at SEIU. And I was in Pittsburgh running a big campaign in Pittsburgh at that point. And Larry said, you know, we've got something happening in Kansas City, and we got to send you on the ground right now because you know how to do this power structure thing. You can size up a place really quickly. And we got to go in there and try and stop the sale of this hospital system of Health Midwest to these big for-profit corporations. And we think that Tenet, you know, maybe is trying to buy up this hospital system, Tenet Healthcare Corporation, and we got to stop it. And we got to stop it because they're a bad company, and that's a bad thing. And that's essentially what I was told. And this is this becomes the history lesson for me as I begin to peel back the onion layers of what was really happening. So, I get on the plane as I'm ordered to do. And I jump on the next flight directly from Pittsburgh to Kansas City, by the way, with a weekend bag. I tell that story in the book because it's funny, but what happened to Health Midwest is not funny, so I'm going to leave out the humor here. So I jump on an airplane, literally from Pittsburgh. I was living in New York City. I don't go home. I go right to Kansas City, and I start meeting people. And how'd I do that? Well, we didn't have much of a base there, so I relied on all the same religious networks and the faith leader networks that I had from Connecticut. And I literally relied on, again, not trade union contracts initially, though Gary Kemp and someone at the building trades becomes very important in the story. But I start with religious leaders from connections I'd made in Connecticut, and I say, who do you know on the ground there? I got to get to some people who know something about what's going on. And I dive into meetings, and I quickly get told by, you know, some trade union people and by some religious leaders, like one of the smartest guys in town, this guy Gary Kemp at the building trades, go meet him too. Okay, great. He was early in my list of people to meet with. And in short order, in about 1 week of nonstop meetings, I'm basically told Health Midwest is a done deal. It's going to be sold to the Tenet Healthcare Corporation, you know, and there's nothing to do about it. So I call headquarters and I say, well, you know, if you had hoped to stop the sale, it's not happening. Now, mind you, SEIU was in a blood-curdling battle to organize Tenet Healthcare hospitals in the state of California, where they were on a growth spurt of hospitals. Unlike Kansas City, where they were trying to buy 15 hospitals from Health Midwest, in California, they already bought up a lot of hospitals, and our union had workers in some of them, and Tenet was trying to be destructive. And in other places, we were in organizing drives, and we were trying to get a big agreement with Tenet Healthcare. So my instructions were to stop the sale, to try and stop the sale. And within a week, I realized Health Midwest was a beloved healthcare system in two states, right, in Missouri and Kansas. You know, I learned a lot about Kansas City in a very short amount of time. And I already knew I didn't like for-profit healthcare. Me personally, Jane McAlevey, I don't believe in a for-profit healthcare system. I want to be super clear about this. So my own personal politics growing up in a very progressive pro-union household were, you know, certain things you can leave to the market, although we shouldn't leave anything entirely to the market, as we now know. But certain things need to be in the public domain. And one of the things that should be in the public domain, by the way, is our healthcare system. Profit should not be mixed up with trying to get people, you know, better and heal them. It's turning out to be a disastrous model. And I'm sure people there can tell us all about that all these years later from what happened there. So I quickly learned that Health Midwest is this very important system. It's near and dear. A bunch of those hot menorah, the Baptist, right, all these. Some were built by the black community. Some were built by the Jews. Like, there's a huge history that's really vital in that region to what that healthcare system was. And now we've got this lecherous for-profit trying to buy them. So I go all out. I mean, I go all out. And people like Gary Kemp, the building trade, a bunch of the religious leaders in both the, really, in the Jewish community and in the black church community. I mean, we stitched together a huge coalition. And then there were also some other, American Federation of Teachers was in there in some of the hospitals. Like, we kicked it up. I mean, we kicked up a big campaign, and I had a lot of resources from SEIU. We started these predictive phone dialer systems. We started doing full-time ads. We took out radio. You know, I brought every tactic in a short-term, what I would call in a short-term mobilizing model, which is real different than what I actually like to do, which is organizing. We'll come back to that. But I dumped every bit of money and brain power into stopping the sale, into stopping a tenant from buying Health Midwest. And by God, in the end, a whole bunch of us together did it. What I didn't understand, which I say in the book, in brief, is that and I can't really prove this. I just surmise it, so I'll say that carefully so I don't get sued on the radio program either. I surmise that there were some machinations going on in our national headquarters, that they understood that if I helped to knock Tenon out of that deal, that it wasn't going to stop it from being sold to a for-profit. It was just going to go to a different one. Right. Meanwhile, I went in there and went crazy, you know, as a mobilizing agent, because I really deeply believed that the Health Midwest system should be saved for the people of Missouri and Kansas and for the KCMO region. And that's why, you know, I can have my own movement moments in my own body and not sleep for days on end when I believe in something very strongly. And I believed in defending Health Midwest from Tenon. What I didn't realize is that the system was going to be lost ultimately anyway. So that's, right. You know, that's a really complicated. And I think it wasn't until about a year after I had already moved on and I was gone from Kansas City that I think it began to make sense to me. Mm-hmm. That my national headquarters was almost in some ways using me in a broader sort of bunch of chess pieces about how to get a deal with both of those hospital systems, HCA and Tenon, in different ways. And it was that campaign was actually a very big deal in the national union that Tenon was defeated. I just felt like, I felt kind of like I needed to have 38,000 showers when I realized that the system was going to go to a for-profit anyway. Because to me, I was campaigning genuinely, like we needed to save Health Midwest and keep it as a nonprofit institution. And right. When I realized that it was going to not go to Tenet, but it was going to go to an equally, in my opinion, bad corporation, there was something really sort of fundamentally wrong with that.
Right. And for our listeners, of course, HCA ultimately bought those hospitals, closed several of them. And
yeah, exactly. Everything
is a difficult
that we predicted,
employer
Judy,
to deal
in that
with.
Campaign, everything that we took out full-page ads about, yeah. You know, where I was sort of driving a public message saying they were going to close some, they were going to consolidate them, they were going to damage some of these communities, all turned out to be true.
Yeah. Well, we need to take a break. We've been talking to Jane McAlevey, author of Raising Expectations, and we'll be back in just a minute.
Man trying to make a living.
Blues, Barbecue, and Brews, a musical evening benefiting All Souls Unitarian Church and KKFI. The performances by Danny Cox and Bob Walkenhorse and the Shawnee Mission East Jazz Band. Saturday, January 30th from 6 to 9 p.m., 4500 Walnut, Kansas City, Missouri. Doors at 5:30, music at 6, dinner served at 6:15. Donation of $25 includes all the music and all you can eat. For just $20, all the music you can hear. Advance tickets available at All Souls Unitarian Church, 10 to 2, Monday through Friday, or at 816-531-2131. Benefiting KKFI and All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church. That's Blues, Barbecue, and Brews on January 30th at 6 p.m. Come on out.
Economic times of uncertainty. Organized labor is in a battle for its very security. With the imminent threat of Social Security privatization, loss of jobs, distrust, and bad labor relations, we must realize that in our hands lies the future of our destiny. The work to be done begins and ends with you and me. I have faith that like the phoenix, the labor movement will rise out of the ashes of old, reborn, renewed, and recommitted to fight against injustice toward workers everywhere. When the contract's up and it's time to negotiate.
We're back. This is Judy Ansel. I'm talking to Jane McAlevey, author of Raising Expectations and Raising Hell. If you're a union activist, a labor activist, and you haven't read this book, you really need to do so. So, Jane, welcome back.
Thank you.
I want you to really briefly talk about a concept you developed in Las Vegas, where you actually spent the longest amount of time as an organizer and union leader, and that's the concept of open bargaining, where you invited nurses all to attend the bargaining session.
Yes. Not only nurses, but everybody. So this is a method that I learned originally from 1199 New England, the healthcare workers union that trained me back in the Northeast. And we had a tradition. In fact, in the union's constitution, it says, and this is very different than most unions, in the constitution of the union that I came out of in Connecticut, it says that every member has the right to attend negotiations. Now, it doesn't mean everyone comes, but it does mean everyone has the right to attend them. And by golly, I will argue if every union had that in their constitution, we'd have a much stronger labor movement right now today. So as a hint to people, I think for rank and filers to demand that negotiations be transparent and be open is like a fundamental litmus test for union democracy in this country. So let me just say, I come out of a union where there was a tradition that members were welcome. And we did a pretty good job, I think, of trying to, you know, our stewards would come. We'd have committees of like 40 or 50 people. That's really big for a traditional union negotiations.
It really makes a lot of leaders
uncomfortable. It was a right-to-work state. Fast forward, you know, that's going to be our whole country soon. But anyway, so I get to Nevada, and it's a right-to-work state. And I start to bargain, and the workers don't have a lot of faith in their union. In fact, it had been a very bad union. And the membership is very small because it's a right-to-work state. And the workers don't like their union very much. And I've now inherited a union that a lot of workers don't trust. They're not paying dues. They're not signed up on membership cards. And I'm there to try and rebuild the union. And so I just decided I'm going to take this concept of open bargaining that I'd learned in Connecticut, and I'm going to blow a hole into it. And I'm just going to say, I want every single worker in the union to attend negotiations. And we literally lay out a goal, which is that every, and I'm talking about thousands of workers, that every single dues-paying member, and even beyond that, because it was a right-to-work state, early on I said to the workers, every worker, even if they're not paying dues, is going to come to negotiations, and our goal is to get them in that room. So there is no better way, there is no better way, in my personal opinion, and having done this, to reinstill faith in what a union is, than to blow the doors open on negotiations and say every worker who's in this shop is invited in. It does two things simultaneously. One, it makes workers understand power. They instantly understand when they're sitting and watching some buffoon lawyer who's flown in from half the, you know, wherever around the country, from some union-busting law firm, who's there to destroy their union and to take their benefits away. When workers themselves get to see the dynamics that go on in the negotiations room, it transforms their understanding of both what collective bargaining means and also of who's in charge, and that if they don't themselves kick up and get really involved in mobilizing for their contract, they're not going to get a very good contract. And so, to me, we then literally rolled it into a model. And I would go into negotiations, and every time I walked into the room, I would have hundreds of workers in the room with me. So we didn't bring thousands in at once. We brought hundreds in at once. It completely freaked the employer out in ways I can almost not even describe to you. We started to win amazing contracts, and the rest is the history of the book. Like, we just began to win everything because workers began to own the union when they understood that they were the union and that the collective bargaining process would be strengthened by their participation and involvement. And literally, I mean, we began to win pensions when all of America's workers were having their pensions taken away, right? We began to have crazy, enormous victories, and we built an 88% membership in the right-to-work state. That's what we did from opening up the collective bargaining process.
Yeah, well, and as right-to-work creeps through the Midwest, I think that's a good lesson for a lot of people.
Yeah.
You know, you said on your webpage, quote, "My central life lesson is that meaningful change can only come with deep and massive relational organizing that puts ordinary people at the center of their own struggles, not pollsters, not lawyers, not Twitter. Essentially, there are no shortcuts, not to real and lasting change." So who is doing that kind of organizing in the United States today, in the labor movement or anywhere?
I'll start with the Chicago teachers. When we saw the enormous strike that played out in 2012 in Chicago, where you had not just 28,000 teachers en masse. I mean, that was basically 100% strike, which is an incredible thing when you think about 28,000 teachers walking off the job. And they're going up against a very powerful mayor at the time. I mean, Rahm Emanuel's had his power knocked down a little bit in the last few months because he made some real bad decisions with his, you know,
police
union, et cetera. But he was... You couldn't have a more powerful mayor than Rahm Emanuel at the moment that those teachers decided to walk off the job and defy him. So that's an example of where really, really transformational organizing is happening right now. The union that trained me, 1199 New England, is a union that is still running supermajority strikes. That's a union where there's really transformational work still happening. And I could basically start going through the country and listing sort of unfortunately, too few examples, but they're still there, and it matters that they're still there because it means that the concept is still real and that real organizing still works. So the kind of work that I was doing in Nevada, like opening up the collective bargaining process, to me is an example of a no shortcuts approach. And by the way, No Shortcuts is the title of my forthcoming book. Mm-hmm. So much of a life lesson is it that I just said, my next book is going to be named No Shortcuts, which is exactly what the title is going to be of a 2016 new book. So to me, in Nevada, when I decided to trust the workers and I have to tell you how crazy this is. When I tell union leaders all over the country and now increasingly over the world that I bargained with an open-door policy and that every single worker was invited in the room and not just invited, but that my entire staff beat the drum every day to get every worker to negotiations and then every worker beat the drum to themselves mobilize their coworkers to negotiations because it was so exciting and so dynamic and they would begin to tell each other, you got to go down to bargaining today. You know, it's an amazing thing to watch our union bargain against our employer. That's an example of a no-shortcuts approach. It means a lot more work for me as a negotiator because having hundreds of people in the room really changes the dynamic, but it's also the most radical and empowering thing that every worker that I talked to in Nevada had ever experienced, right? So that's about empowering workers themselves to be in charge. When the Chicago teachers said we're going to defy the most powerful mayor in the country, and the only way we're going to save the public school system from being closed, and those teachers really struck to save the school system, not just to save, a wage package. And they went to the broader community and they said, look, we're going to have to walk off the job to try and stop this mayor from destroying public schools and privatizing the whole system. And if we do it, we're going to have to count on you for your support. Guess what the people of Chicago said to them? We're with you. And so when they walked off the job, 28,000 strong, and Rahm Emanuel, the mayor of Chicago, went on the news the next day and tried to organize every parent against them, guess what the parents were doing? They were throwing barbecues on the picket lines for the teachers. And they said, no, we're standing with Chicago's teachers against you because we understand that the struggle that these teachers are undertaking is a struggle about building a working class movement in defense of public education for the public masses in our city. And I wrote a chapter on it in my forthcoming book. And when I went and did interviews with parents and students and teachers in Chicago in the aftermath of their strike, I thought, holy smackerel, it's happening here too. So, when we do our work right, when we don't take shortcuts, when we embed ourselves in the community, when we understand that workers are also parents with children themselves in the public schools, and they want a good public school system, we will win the community over to the course of labor when the course of labor is on the side of the community. It's really very straightforward proposition, and that's what taking a no-shortcuts approach means.
Coming back to Kansas City, we're a smaller city. Our unions don't get a whole lot of attention from their internationals or resources, to tell you the truth. There's not much organizing going on here. One thing that is going on is the Fight for 15. And the organization Stand Up KC is actually doing some of those things and not just doing what I guess you'd call shortcuts. But let me ask you, what advice would you give our unions here in Kansas City to try to jumpstart more organizing going on?
Sure. I mean, honestly, first of all, every place where the Fight for 15 is energizing people, I think that that's a good thing, just to be super clear. What worries me about it in some cities is that I'm afraid it's a very mobilizing, focused model. But to me, if I was sitting in a union where the members were not very excited about what was happening and they were really disconnected, I would literally make the decision that we made in Nevada, because that's what I inherited in Nevada, a union where not much was happening. Workers were really disconnected. The union seemed like a Geico insurance, car policy sitting in, you ring up that building, wherever that is, I get in a crash, I'm going to call the union. And that's what the union was reduced to in Nevada when I first got there. And I think the most radical thing that people can do is for the workers who are in the union, is shift the bargaining process. And once you begin to get an excited workforce again inside of the union, because you will begin to realize, wait a minute, we can actually stand up and fight for a better contract, and when we unify, we can actually win. What happened in Nevada was that we did one very big, my first contract fight there, we shifted that whole bargaining model. And because we won so much, and there was a lot of press coverage because we were getting a lot of press attention because we were holding a lot of rallies by the end of that big, very first contract fight. So we have workers in motion. And then the press starts coming in. The workers got in motion because I blew the doors open on how negotiations happen. So the workers begin to believe in their union again. Then they start coming to protest because now they understand that they're fighting themselves to make their lives better in their contract fight. Then the press start coming to cover their rallies. Then we win this really terrific contract that had minimum 10% raises for 2 years in it and maximums that were much higher. We had a minimum maximum strategy because I was trying to get all the workers onto a pay scale. So some workers were getting 22% raises and some were getting 10% raises in a state where people had been concession bargaining. Then guess what happens? The phone starts ringing off the hook, and workers in not yet union hospitals start calling our office saying, how do we get that contract? And I'd say, well, first you got to form a union. And they'd say, well, how do we do that? I mean, it's a series of steps that everyone in Kansas City is perfectly capable of taking. But you got to trust the workers. You got to have faith in the workers. The unions have to shed some of the ways they've been doing things for the last 50 years because they're not working anymore. And to me, the life lesson about no shortcuts is that when you really trust that workers are grown-ups that make really big decisions in their lives every day, like how do we teach our kids to be good kids? How do we raise our children? That they're also capable of walking into the bargaining room and understanding how to negotiate a collective bargaining agreement. And a lot will actually begin to change when America's unions just stop thinking that a model that was working in the 1960s and 70s is going to work today, because it's not working. It's just not working anymore. The mechanisms of having a union aren't the problem. It's how we're running them that's a problem. And when we trust that ordinary rank-and-file workers have brains and hearts and can think really maturely about strategy in a contract, once we begin to train people what's contract strategy, everything will begin to change. And I just can't say enough about what it means to open up the bargaining process to rebuild, you know, a sort of moribund union, which is a lot of what we got out there, right? And it's not just in Kansas City, so don't feel bad there.
No, and actually, you know, we have some pretty good unions, but they're not
exactly
organizing.
And I knew that from when I was in Kansas City. I met some really good unions there.
Yeah. Of course, one of the great obstacles, I think, is the internal fights that unions have and waste a tremendous amount of energy on. A major theme of your book is the reason why you left SEIU, I think, was the fratricidal fights within the labor movement. You give us many examples, internal, inside locals, between different unions, between different parts of international unions. Lots of egotistical leaders. We won't name names. I know she won't. Why does this happen over and over again? And do you have any solution for it?
Yeah, I mean, again, I want to go back to the Chicago teachers for a minute, and also to my old union local, 1199 New England, which is in Connecticut and Rhode Island, because the story of my old local, I think, is a testament to the fact that it doesn't have to happen. It never has happened in that union. Well, not never. I mean, never is a bit of an extreme word. But, you know, the fact that there are unions where this has not happened a lot, we have to look at them. And part of what I do in the new book is I look at the unions where there's been a sort of long track record of success, and then I look at unions where they've rebuilt, like in Chicago. And so the storyline in Chicago on how do we avoid this fratricidal, ridiculous thing that goes on in our trade union movement goes back to almost the bargaining discussion. It's about union democracy, and it's about workers. It's about ordinary workers deciding that they're going to make their union good. It's not any different than deciding that we're going to make our city good or our state better, you know, or our city council better. Unions, in fact, have constitutions, and they have democratic mechanisms, but they've atrophied. So in Chicago had a mighty teachers union right up into the mid-1980s, and then their union began to slide because they elected some bad leadership, just like we elected – we didn't elect George Bush. Okay, never mind. But just like we can elect bad leaders and they can really wreck our democracy, like in Flint, Michigan, where, you know – can we just talk about Flint, Michigan? This all relates. Flint, Michigan, where the privatization, you know, of the water system just poisoned – thousands of young children with lead, which we know is incredibly damaging to young kids. This is all related to, like, fratricide and unions, and I kid you not. Because in Michigan, when we let democracy atrophy because Michigan Governor Rick Snyder overturned, you know, a citizen ballot and reinstituted emergency measures, and he took away democracy in Flint, and he appointed an emergency manager and he ended democracy. What we have right now is a bunch of kids being poisoned by short-term decision-making in an anti-democratic system that actually threatens democracy in our country is what we sometimes have in our trade union movement. And when I try and explain to rank-and-file workers who I meet who tell me they're upset about that they don't feel like their union listens to them, I say, you can't be quiet about that. In Chicago, the union had atrophied, the teachers' union. It had really become, you know, a kind of a bad trade union, which is not unique to Chicago. And so a bunch of good teachers got together and said, enough is enough in this union. We're going to take our union over. We're going to run for office. We're going to go out and shake cans and raise money as a bunch of teachers, and we're going to rebuild our union. And by golly, it didn't take them long to do it. They got a copy of the union constitution. They began to study it. They didn't set out initially to take over the union. They simply set out to do something really beautiful, which was to make their union behave like a union again. I quote a bunch of the teachers who were involved in the change process in Chicago, which really began in earnest in about 2007. The first meetings of a bunch of rank-and-file trade union teachers in Chicago said, our union's bad. We need to make it better. And so they got together and they formed a caucus, you know, voluntary caucus, and they said, we're going to start to meet and make our union behave like a union again. And then they realized a lot of people agreed with them. And lo and behold, by 2010, it turns out that they decide they're going to run for office and they take over the union. And they have built a vibrant union in a very short period of time, and it can happen. And I think it's so important to look at that recent example. And it's just like in Nevada. I tell people in Nevada, very short period of time, workers rebuilt the union. Now, is that going to instantly end the fratricide? No, it's not, because we saw that national union leaders came into Nevada and basically wrecked the place. So part of why I keep writing books right now is to tell more and more lessons about how to avoid that. And I think the Chicago Teachers Union has some really good lessons for how to not let oligarchy and not let other bad people take control of your unions. And I think I was a little bit naive about it in Nevada, just like I was naive about maybe some of the reasons that they sent me to Kansas City, maybe. And I think that we have to tell these life lessons and we have to tell these stories, because in Chicago they're not going to allow the same kind of mistakes that we made in Nevada to happen. You know, they've got, and even in 1199 New England, the union I came out of, they've got a mechanism in the union constitution that says the union can never be put into trusteeship by the national union unless 75% of the local rank-and-file members vote themselves to have their union taken over or trusted by the national union. Well, it's not going to get taken over by the national union because there's a constitutional mechanism that's going to block that. So that's a smart pro-democracy, pro-union democracy mechanism. It's very important that we instill union democracy inside of our unions, because that helps avoid the sort of stupid, crazy fratricide that takes place across and between our unions. You described it well. I don't have to. But in my next book, I sort of am highlighting sort of some of the measures of union democracy that help avoid pitfalls of these inter-union wars that really do nothing but hurt ordinary workers.
So when's your next book coming out?
No, 2016. But I think it's going to hit the bookshelves for Labor Day, basically, so early September.
Well, we'd love to have you back to talk about a little bit more about that when it does come out. I wanted to ask you about your recent interview about Hillary Clinton, but I think I'll just put a link on our website. So if people want to know what Jane McAlvey thinks about Hillary Clinton's labor record, they can go to it on Real News. And thank you so much, Jane McAlvey, for being on the Heartland Labor Forum. This is really inspiring.
I miss Kansas City, and I'm very glad to have spent time with you, and my best wishes to everyone there.
We'll have to bring you back, not to save our hospital system, but maybe to speak.
Thanks very much, Judy.
Thanks, Jane. And we're rocking along right here with Mark Grunberg with Washington Window on Workers. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Judy. Good afternoon. Good evening, everybody.
So I want to talk to you about an International Trade Commission hearing on the Trans-Pacific Partnership that took place last week, I guess it was. Did you attend it?
No, I wound up getting the statements afterwards. It was the weekend of Martin Luther King. Actually, it was sort of the same weekend that Martin Luther King Day was being honored, and I was busy at the Martin Luther King Forum.
Got it. So anyway, tell our listeners, what is the International Trade Commission?
This is a commission that basically hears that normally, hears tariff cases. If China dumps tires on us, or fax paper, or steel, or something like that, then our industries, and usually it's our unions, actually, have been doing this, take the case to the ITC and say, hey, look, there's dumping.
Investigate this,
and then the ITC decides if there is dumping to slap on tariffs.
Got it. Okay, so they're doing a study of the Trans-Pacific Partnership and will put together a report for Congress before Congress votes up or down on the TPP. Have they ever done a report that's like gives the real point of view of working people, or are they mainly just reflecting corporate interests usually?
Actually, this is a first for them. They often side with on these individual cases, you know, product by product with workers. They very frequently side. But this is a whole big thing. They're being asked to look at the entire TPP, at its effect on the entire workforce.
Really?
At its effect on the entire economy. Indeed, one of the things that the co-worker witnesses, Leo Gerard and the others, said was, when you look at the effect on workers, don't use an economic model that the proponents of the TPP have urged you to use, which is a full employment economy and rising wages. Use what's really going on out there.
In other words, use the experience of NAFTA and CAFTA and all the other trade agreements in order to try to predict what's going to happen. So, okay.
Exactly.
Leo Gerard, the president of the Steelworkers Union, talked about the weaknesses of the TPP as far as workers' rights. What did he say there?
Well, he said basically that there is a workers' section, but it is so vague and there's no enforcement that it's meaningless. He highlighted that, you know, it has words for the other for the TPP nations, may do something, you know, as appropriate, possibly could, quote unquote, unquote, unquote. And again, no enforcement whatsoever.
So, drawing on
past experience, he says this is valueless.
Okay. And then finally, and then we're out of time, Sherrod Brown talked about China. And what did he say? That's Senator Sherrod Brown.
He said it's the elephant in the room.
Yeah.
He said it's the elephant in the room. Our past trade pacts, all these trade treaties, NAFTA, CAFTA, so on and so forth, have been with specific countries, and that's it. The TPP has a reopener clause that allows other countries to join in down the line, and that means China. And Sherrod said, A, you got to talk about the elephant in the room, and B, you got to talk about, can China transship things through the TPP countries and thus take advantage of us that way.
Got it. So, okay, well, that's all we have time for, Mark. We'll talk to you next month. Thank you so much.
Okay.
All right. Okay, bye-bye.
And this is the Heartland Labor Forum calendar for January 28, 2016. Rally against the Trans-Pacific Partnership, Tuesday, February 2nd, 9 a.m., Federal Building, 12th and Cherry, downtown. Jobs with Justice Organizing Committee meeting, Tuesday, February 2nd, 6:30 p.m., All Souls UU Church, 4501 Walnut. And go to www.heartlandlaborforum.org for the rest of our calendar.
And for our archived shows. That's it for tonight's show. Tune in next week. We're going to be talking to the presidential frontrunners about whether or not they're friends of labor. This will be an exciting show. Thanks to our engineer, Jen Zaman.
You have been listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. We are sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Our volunteers come from a wide variety of workplaces and unions. We are supported by many Kansas City area unions and the AFL-CIO. To talk back to us, to volunteer, or to let us know about news or events, call us at 816-235-1100. 1470 or go to www.heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here on 90.1 FM KKFI.